his souls into flesh again.
Cess is the last and makes the proof.
My father's gaze was far away, as if he were looking through sea and earth all the way to Colchis. It might have been some trick of the hearth fire, but I thought the light of his face flickered.
Shall I give you a demonstration?
My brother drew out from his robes a small pot with a wax seal. He broke the seal and touched his finger to the liquid inside. I smelt something sharp and green with a brackish edge. He pressed his thumb to my face and spoke a word too low for me to hear. My skin began to itch, and then, like a taper snuffed out, the pain was gone. When I put my hand to my cheek, I felt only smoothness, and a faint sheen as if from oil.
A good trick, is it not? Aiti said.
My father did not answer. He sat strangely dumb.
I felt struck dumb myself.
The power of healing another's flesh belonged only to the greatest gods, not to such as us. My brother smiled, as if he could hear my thoughts.
And that is the least of my powers. They are drawn from the earth itself, and so are not bound by the normal laws of divinity.
He let the words hang a moment in the air.
I understand, of course, that you can make no judgment now. You must take counsel. But you should know that I would be happy to give Zeus a more impressive demonstration.
A look flashed in his eyes like teeth in a wolf's mouth. My father's words came slowly. That same numbness still masked his face.
I understood with an odd jolt. He is afraid.
I must take counsel, as you say. This is new. Until it is decided, you will remain in these halls, both of you.
I expected no less, Aiti said.
He inclined his head and turned to go. I followed, skin prickling with the rush of my thoughts and a breathless, rearing hope.
The Merwood doors shut behind us, and we stood in the hall.
Aiti's face was calm, as if he had not just performed a miracle and silenced our father.
I had 1,000 questions ready to tumble out, but he spoke first.
What have you been doing all this while? You took forever. I was beginning to think maybe you weren't a Pharmacus after all.
It was not a word I knew.
It was not a word anyone knew, then.
Pharmacus, I said.
Which?
News ran like spring rivers. At dinner, the children of Oceanus whispered when they saw me and skittered out of my path. If our arms brushed, they paled. And when I passed a goblet to a river god, his eyes dodged away.
Oh, no, thank you, I'm not thirsty.
Aetes laughed. You will get used to it.
We are ourselves alone now.
He did not seem alone.
Every night he sat on my grandfather's dais with my father and our uncles. I watched him drinking nectar, laughing, showing his teeth. His expressions darted like schools of fish in the water, now light, now dark. I waited till our father was gone, then went to sit on a chair near him. I longed to take the place beside him on the couch, lean against his shoulder, but he seemed so grim and straight. I did not know how to touch him.
You like your kingdom, Colchis?
It is the finest in the world, he said. I have done what I said, sister. I have gathered there all the wonders of our lands. I smiled to hear him call me sister, to speak of those old dreams.
I wish I could see it.
He said nothing. He was a magician who could break the teeth of snakes, tear up oaks by their roots.
He did not need me.
Do you have Daedalus too? He made a face.
No. Pasiphae has him trapped.
Perhaps in time. I have a giant fleece made of gold, though, and 6 dragons. I did not have to draw his stories out of him. They burst forth, the spells and charms he cast, the beasts he summoned, the herbs he cut by moonlight and brewed into miracles. Each tale was more outlandish than the last. Thunder leaping to his fingertips, lambs cooked and born again from their charred bones.
What was it you spoke when you healed my skin?
A word of power. Will you teach it to me?
Sorcery cannot be taught.
You find it yourself, or you do not. I thought of the humming I had heard when I touched those flowers, the eerie knowledge that had glided through me.
How long have you known you could do such things?
since I was born, he said.
But I had to wait until I was out from Father's eye. All those years beside me, and he had said nothing. I opened my mouth to demand, how could you not tell me, but this new Aetes in his vivid robes was too unnerving. Were you not afraid, I said, that Father would be angry?
No. I was not fool enough to try to humiliate him in front of everyone. He lifted his eyebrows at me and I flushed. Anyway, he is eager to imagine how such strength may be used to his benefit. His worry is over Zeus. He must paint us just right, that we are threat enough that Zeus should think twice, but not so much that he is forced to act.
My brother, who had always seen into the cracks of the world.
What if the Olympians try to take your spells from you?
He smiled. I think they cannot, whatever they try.
As I said, Pharmakeia is not bound by the usual limits of gods.
I looked down at my hands and tried to imagine them weaving a spell to shake the world. But the certainty I had felt when I dripped the sap into Glaucus's mouth and tainted Scylla's cove, I could not seem to find any more. Perhaps, I thought, if I could touch those flowers again. But I was not allowed to leave until my father spoke to Zeus.
And you think I can work such wonders as you do?
No, my brother said. I am the strongest of the four of us. But you do show a taste for transformation.
That was only the flowers, I said. They grant creatures their truest forms.
He turned his philosopher's eye on me. You do not think it convenient that their truest forms should happen to be your desires?
I stared at him.
I did not desire to make Scylla a monster. I only meant to reveal the ugliness within her.
And you believe that's what was truly in her, a six-headed, slavering horror?
My face was stinging.
Why not? You did not know her. She was very cruel.
He laughed.
Oh, Circe. She was a painted back-hall slattern, same as the rest. If you will argue one of the greatest monsters of our age was hiding within her, then you are more of a fool than I thought.
I do not think anyone can say what is in someone else.
He rolled his eyes and poured himself another cup.
What I think, he said, is that Scylla has escaped the punishment you intended for her.
What do you mean?
Think. What would an ugly nymph do in our halls? What is the worth of her life?
It was like the old days, him asking and me without answers.
I don't know.
Of course you do. It's why it would have been a good punishment. Even the most beautiful nymph is largely useless, and an ugly one would be nothing, less than nothing. She would never marry or produce children. She would be a burden to her family, a stain upon the face of the world. She would live in the shadows, scorned and reviled.
But a monster, he said.
She always has a place. She may have all the glory her teeth can snatch. She will not be loved for it. But she will not be constrained either. So whatever foolish sorrow you harbor, forget it. I think it may be said that you improved her. For 2 nights, my father was closeted with my uncles. I lingered outside the mahogany doors, but could hear nothing, not even a murmur. When they emerged, their faces were set and grim. My father strode to his chariot. His purple cloak glowed dark as wine, and on his head shone his great crown of golden rays. He did not look back as he leapt into the sky and turned the horses towards Olympus. We waited in Oceanus's halls for his return. No one lounged on the riverbank or twined with a lover in the shadows. The naiads squabbled with red cheeks. The river gods shoved each other. From his dais, my grandfather stared out over all of us, his cup empty in his hand. My mother was boasting among her sisters. Perses and Pasiphae were the ones who knew first, of course. Is it any wonder Circe was last? I plan to have 100 more, and they will make me a silver boat that flies through the clouds. We will rule upon Olympus. Perse, my grandmother hissed across the room. Only Aetes did not seem to feel the tension. He sat serene on his couch, drinking from his wrought gold cup. I kept to the back, pacing the long passageways, running my hands over the rock walls, always faintly damp from the presence of so many water gods. I scanned the room to see if Glaucus had come.
There was still a piece of me that longed to look upon him even then. When I asked Aeetes if Glaucus feasted with the rest of the gods, he had grinned. He's hiding that blue face of his. He's waiting for everyone to forget the truth of how he came by it. My stomach twisted. I had not thought how my confession would take Glaucus's greatest pride from him. Too late, I thought. Too late for all the things I should have known. I had made so many mistakes that I could not find my way back through their tangle to the first one. Was it changing Scylla, changing Glaucus, swearing the oath to my grandmother, speaking to Glaucus in the first place? I felt a sickening unease that it went back further still, back to the first breath I ever drew. My father would be standing before Zeus now. My brother was sure that the Olympians could do nothing to us. But four Titan witches could not be easily dismissed. What if war came again? The great hall would crack open over us. Zeus's head would blot out the light and his hand would reach down to crush us one by one. Aeetes would call his dragons. At least he could fight. But what could I do? Pick flowers? My mother was bathing her feet. Two sisters held the silver basin. A third poured the sweet myrrh oil from its flask. I was being a fool, I told myself. There would be no war. My father was an old hand at such maneuvering. He would find a way to appease Zeus. The room brightened and my father came. On his face was a look like hammered bronze. Our eyes followed him as he strode to the dais at the room's front. The rays from his crown speared every shadow. He stared out over us. I have spoken to Zeus, he said. We have found our way to an agreement. A suffering relief from my cousins like wind through wheat. He agrees that something new moves in the world, that these powers are unlike any that have come before. He agrees that they grow from my four children with the nymph Perse. A ripple again. This one tinged with growing excitement. My mother licked her lips, tilting her chin as if there were already a crown on her head. Her sisters glanced at each other, gnawing on their envy. We have agreed as well that these powers present no immediate danger. Perseus lives beyond our boundaries and is no threat. Pasiphaeus's husband is the son of Zeus, and he will be sure she is held to her proper place. Aeetes will keep his kingdom so long as he agrees to be watched. My brother nodded gravely, but I saw the smile in his eyes. I can veil the sky itself. Just try to watch me. Each of them has sworn besides that their powers came unbidden and unlooked for from no malice or attempted revolt. They stumbled upon the magic of herbs by accident. Surprised, I darted another glance at my brother, but his face was unreadable. Each of them, except for Circe. You were all here when she confessed that she sought her powers openly. She had been warned to stay away, yet she disobeyed. My grandmother's face. Cold in her ivory-carved chair. She defied my commands and contradicted my authority. She has turned her poisons against her own kind and committed other treacheries as well. The white seer of his gaze landed on me. She is a disgrace to our name, an ingrate to the care we have shown her. It is agreed with Zeus that for this she must be punished. She is exiled to a deserted island where she can do no more harm. She leaves tomorrow. 1,000 eyes pinned me. I wanted to cry out, to plead, but my breath would not catch. My voice, ever thin, was gone. Aeetes will speak for me, I thought, but when I cast my gaze to him, he only looked back with all the rest. One more thing, my father said. As I noted, it is clear that the source of this new power comes from my union with Perse. My mother's face. Glossy with triumph, beaming through my haze. So it is agreed, I will sire no more children upon her. My mother screamed, falling backwards on her sister's laps. Her sobs echoed off the stone walls. My grandfather got slowly to his feet. He rubbed at his chin. Well, he said, it is time for the feast. The torches burnt like stars. And overhead the ceiling stretched high as the sky's vault. For the last time I watched all the gods and nymphs take their places. I felt dazed. I should say goodbye, I kept thinking.
But my cousins flowed away from me like water around a rock. I heard their sneering whispers as they passed. I found myself missing Scylla. At least she would have dared to speak to my face. My grandmother, I thought, I must try to explain. But she turned away as well, and her sea snake buried its head. All the while my mother wept in her flock of sisters. When I came close, she raised her face so everyone could see her beautiful, extravagant grief. Have you not done enough? That left only my uncles, with their kelp hair and briny, scraggled beards. Yet when I thought of kneeling at their feet, I could not bring myself to do it. I went back to my room. Pack, I told myself. Pack, you are leaving tomorrow. But my hands hung numbly at my sides. How should I know what to bring? I had scarcely ever left these halls. I forced myself to find a bag, to gather clothes and sandals, a brush for my hair. I considered a tapestry on my wall. It was of a wedding and its party, woven by some aunt. Would I even have a house to hang it in? I did not know. I did not know anything. A deserted island, my father had said. Would it be bare rock exposed upon the sea, a pebbled shoal, a tangled wilderness? My bag was an absurdity, filled of gilded detritus. The knife, I thought, the lion's head knife, I will bring that. But when I held it, it looked shrunken, meant to spear up morsels at a feast and no more. It could have been much worse, you know. Aetes had come to stand in my doorway. He was leaving too, his dragons already summoned. I heard Zeus wanted to make an example of you, but of course father can only allow him so much license. The hairs stirred on my arms. You did not tell him about Prometheus, did you? He smiled. Why, because he spoke of other treacheries. You know, father, he's only been cautious in case some further terror of yours comes to light. Anyway, what is there to tell? What did you do, after all? Pour a single glass of nectar? I looked up. You said father would have thrown me to the crows for it. Only if you were fool enough to admit it. My face was hot. I suppose I should take you as my tutor and deny everything. Yes, he said. That is how it works, Circe. I tell father that my sorcery was an accident, he pretends to believe me, and Zeus pretends to believe him, and so the world is balanced. It is your own fault for confessing. Why you did that, I will never understand. It was true. He would not. He had not been born when Prometheus was whipped. I meant to tell you, he said. I finally met your Glaucus last night. I have never seen such a buffoon. He clicked his tongue. I hope you will choose better ahead. You have always trusted too easily. I looked at him leaning in my doorway with his long robes and bright wolfish eyes. My heart had leapt to see him as it always did. He was like that column of water he had told me of once, cold and straight, sufficient to himself. Thank you for your counsel, I said. He left and I considered the tapestry again. Its groom was goggle-eyed, the bride buried in her veils, and behind them the family gaped like idiots. I had always hated it. Let it stay and rot. Chapter 7. The next morning I stepped into my father's chariot, and we lurched into the dark sky without a word. The air blew past us. Night receded at every turning of the wheels. I looked over the side, trying to track the rivers and seas, the shadowed valleys, but we were going too fast and I recognized nothing. What island is it? My father did not answer. His jaw was set. His lips bled pale with anger. My old burns were aching from standing so close to him. I closed my eyes. The lands streamed by and the wind ran across my skin. I imagined pitching over that golden rail into the open air below. It would feel good, I thought, before I hid. We landed with a jolt. I opened my eyes to see a high, soft hill, thick with grass. My father stared straight ahead. I felt a sudden urge to fall on my knees and beg him to take me back. But instead, I forced myself to step down onto the ground. The moment my foot touched, he and his chariot were gone.
I stood alone in that grassy clearing. The breeze blew sharp against my cheeks, and the air had a fresh scent. I could not savor it. My head felt heavy, and my throat had begun to ache. I swayed. By now, Aetes was back on Colchis, drinking his milk and honey. My aunts would be laughing on their riverbanks. My cousins returned to their games. My father, of course, was overhead, shedding his light down on the world. All those years I had spent with them were like a stone tossed in a pool. Already the ripples were gone. I had a little pride. If they did not weep, I would not either. I pressed my palms to my eyes until they cleared. I made myself look around. On the hilltop before me was a house, wide-porched, its walls built from finely fitted stone, its doors carved twice the height of a man. A little below stretched a hem of forests, and beyond that a glimpse of the sea. It was the forest that drew my eye. It was old growth, gnarled with oaks and lindens and olive groves, shot through with spearing cypress. That's where the green scent came from, drifting up the grassy hillside. The trees shook themselves thickly in the sea winds, and birds darted through the shadows. Even now, I can remember the wonder I felt. All my life had been spent in the same dim halls, or walking the same stunted shore with its threadbare woods. I was not prepared for such profusion, and I felt the sudden urge to throw myself in like a frog into a pond. I hesitated. I was no wood nymph. I did not have the knack of feeling my way over roots or walking through brambles untouched. I could not guess what those shadows might conceal. What if there were sinkholes within? What if they were bears or lions? I stood there a long time, fearing such things and waiting, as if someone would come and reassure me, say, "Yes, you may go, it will be safe." My father's chariot slipped over the sea and began to douse itself in the waves. The shadows of the forest deepened and the trunks seemed to twine against each other. "It is too late to go now," I told myself. "Tomorrow." The doors of the house were broad oak, banded with iron. They swung easily at my touch. Inside, the air smelt of incense. There was a great room set with tables and benches as if for a feast. A hearth anchored one end. At the other, a corridor led away to the kitchen and bedrooms. It was large enough to hold a dozen goddesses, and indeed, I kept expecting to find nymphs and cousins around every turn. But no, that was part of my exile. To be utterly alone. What worse punishment could there be, my family thought, than to be deprived of their divine presence? Certainly the house itself was no punishment. Treasures shone on every side, carved chests, soft rugs and golden hangings, beds, stools, intricate tripods and ivory statues. The windowsills were white marble, the shutters scrolled ashwood. In the kitchen I ran my thumb across the knives, bronze and iron, but also nacre shell and obsidian. I found bowls of quartz crystal and wrought silver. Though the rooms were deserted, there was no speck of dust, and I would learn that none could cross the marble threshold. However I tracked upon it, the floor was always clean, the tables gleaming. The ashes vanished from the fireplace, the dishes washed themselves, and the firewood regrew overnight. In the pantry there were jars of oil and wine, bowls of cheese and barley grain, always fresh and full. Among those empty, perfect rooms, I felt, I could not say, disappointed. There was a part of me, I think, that had hoped for a crag in the Caucasus after all, and an eagle diving for my liver. But Scylla was no Zeus, and I was no Prometheus. We were nymphs, not worth the trouble. There was more to it than that, though. My father might have left me in a hovel or a fisherman's shack, on a bare beach with nothing but a tent. I thought back to his face when he spoke of Zeus's decree, his clear, ringing rage. I had assumed it was all for me, but now, after my talks with Aetes, I began to understand more. The truce between the gods held only because Titans and Olympians each kept to their sphere. Zeus had demanded the discipline of Helios's blood.
Helios could not speak back openly, but he could make an answer of sorts, a message of defiance to rebalance the scales. Even our exiles live better than kings. You see how deep our strength runs. If you strike us, Olympian, we rise higher than before. That was my new home, a monument to my father's pride. It was past sundown by then. I found the flint and struck it over the waiting tinder, as I had seen Glaukos do so often, but never attempted myself. It took me several tries, and when the flames began to catch and spread at last, I felt a novel satisfaction. I was hungry, so I went to the pantry, where the bowls brimmed with enough food to feed 100. I spooned some onto a plate and sat at one of the great oak tables in the hall. I could hear the sound of my breath. It struck me that I had never eaten by myself. Even when no one spoke to me or looked at me, there was always some cousin or sibling at my elbow. I rubbed the fine-grained wood. I hummed a little and listened to the sound being swallowed by the air. This is what it will be all my days, I thought. Despite the fire, shadows were gathering in the corners. Outside, birds had begun to scream. At least I thought they were birds. I felt the hairs stir on my neck. Thinking again of those dark, thick trunks, I went to the shutters and closed them. I latched the door. I was used to the weight of all the earth's rocks surrounding me and my father's power on top of that. The house's walls felt to me leaf-thin. Any claw would tear them open. Perhaps that is the secret of this place, I thought. My true punishment is yet to come. Stop, I told myself. I lit tapers and made myself carry them down the hall to my room. In the daylight it had seemed large, and I had been pleased, but now I could not watch every corner at once. The feathers of the bed murmured against each other, and the shutter would creak like the ropes of ships in a storm. All around me I felt the wild hollows of the island swelling in their dark. Until that moment, I had not known how many things I feared. Huge, ghostly leviathans slithering up the hillside, nightworms squirming out of their burrows, pressing their blind faces to my door. Goat-footed gods eager to feed their savage appetites, pirates muffling their oars in my harbor, planning how they would take me. And what could I do? Pharmacus, Aetes named me, witch. But all my strength was in those flowers, oceans away. If anyone came, I would only be able to scream. And 1,000 nymphs before me knew what good that did. The fear sloshed over me, each wave colder than the last. The still air crawled across my skin and shadows reached out their hands. I stared into the darkness, straining to hear past the beat of my own blood. Each moment felt the length of a night. But at last the sky took on a deepening texture and began to pale at its edge. The shadows ebbed away and it was morning. I stood up, whole and untouched. When I went outside, there were no prowling footprints, no slithering tail marks, no gouges clawed in the door. Yet I did not feel foolish. I felt as if I had passed a great ordeal. I looked again into that forest. Yesterday, was it only yesterday? I had waited for someone to come and tell me it was safe. But who would that be? My father? Aetes? That is what exile meant. No one was coming, no one ever would. There was fear in that knowledge. But after my long night of terrors, it felt small and inconsequential. The worst of my cowardice had been sweated out. In its place was a giddy spark. I will not be like a bird bred in a cage, I thought, too dull to fly even when the door stands open. I stepped into those woods, and my life began. I learned to braid my hair back so it would not catch on every twig, and how to tie my skirts at the knee to keep the burrs off. I learned to recognize the different blooming vines and gaudy roses, to spot the shining dragonflies and coiling snakes. I climbed the peaks where the cypresses speared black into the sky, then clambered down to the orchards and vineyards where purple grapes grew thick as coral. I walked the hills, the buzzing meadows of thyme and lilac, and set my footprints across the yellow beaches. I searched out every cove and grotto, found the gentle bays, the harbor safe for ships. I heard the wolves howl and the frogs cry from their mud.
I stroked the glossy brown scorpions who braved me with their tails. Their poison was barely a pinch. I was drunk, as the wine and nectar in my father's halls had never made me. No wonder I have been so slow, I thought. All this while I have been a weaver without wool, a ship without the sea. Yet now look where I sail. At night I went home to my house. I did not mind its shadows anymore, for they meant my father's gaze was gone from the sky, and the hours were my own. I did not mind the emptiness either. For 1,000 years I had tried to fill the space between myself and my family. Filling the rooms of my house was easy by comparison. I burned cedar in the fireplace, and its dark smoke kept me company. I sang, which had never been allowed before, since my mother said I had the voice of a drowning gull. And when I did get lonely, when I found myself yearning for my brother, or Glaucus as he had been, then there was always the forest. The lizards darted along the branches, the birds flashed their wings. The flowers, when they saw me, seemed to press forward like eager puppies, leaping and clamoring for my touch. I felt almost shy of them, but day by day I grew bolder, and at last I knelt in the damp earth before a clump of hellebore. The delicate blooms fluttered on their stalks. I did not need a knife to cut them, only the edge of my nail, which grew sticky with flecks of sap. I put the flowers in a basket covered with cloth, and only uncovered them when I was home again, my shutters firmly closed. I did not think anyone would try to stop me, but I did not intend to tempt them to it. I looked at the blossoms lying on my table. They seemed shrunken, etiolated. I did not have the first idea what I should do to them. Chop? Boil? Roast? There had been oil in my brother's ointment, but I did not know what kind. Would olive from the kitchen work? Surely not. It must be something fantastical, like seed oil pressed from the fruits of the Hesperides. But I could not get that. I rolled a stalk beneath my finger. It turned over, limp as a drowned worm. Well, I said to myself, do not just stand there like a stone. Try something. Boil them. Why not? I had a little pride, as I have said, and that was good. More would have been fatal. Let me say what sorcery is not. It is not divine power, which comes with a thought and a blink. It must be made and worked, planned and searched out, dug up, dried, chopped and ground, cooked, spoken over and sung. Even after all that, it can fail, as gods do not. If my herbs are not fresh enough, if my attention falters, if my will is weak, the drafts go stale and rancid in my hands. By rights, I should never have come to witchcraft. Gods hate all toil, 'tis their nature. The closest we come is weaving or smithing, but these things are skills, and there is no drudgery to them, since all the parts that might be unpleasant are taken away with power. The wool is dyed not with stinking vats and stirring spoons, but with a snap. There is no tedious mining. The ores leap willingly from the mountain. No fingers are ever chafed, no muscle strained. Witchcraft is nothing but such drudgery. Each herb must be found in its den, harvested at its time, grubbed up from the dirt, culled and stripped, washed and prepared. It must be handled this way, then that, to find out where its power lies. Day upon patient day. You must throw out your errors and begin again. So why did I not mind? Why did none of us mind? I cannot speak for my brothers and sister, but my answer is easy. For 100 generations, I had walked the world drowsy and dull, idle and at my ease. I left no prints, I did no deeds. Even those who had loved me a little did not care to stay. Then I learned that I could bend the world to my will, as a bow is bent for an arrow. I would have done that toil 1,000 times to keep such power in my hands. I thought, this is how Zeus felt when he first lifted the thunderbolt. At first, of course, all I brewed were mistakes. Drafts that did nothing, pastes that crumbled and lay dead on the table. I thought that if some rue was good, more was better. That 10 herbs mixed were superior to 5, that I could let my mind wander and the spell would not wander with it, that
I could begin making one draft and halfway through decide to make another. I did not know even the simplest herb lore that any mortal would learn at her mother's knee, that wort plants boiled make a sort of soap, that yew burnt in the hearth sends up a choking smog, that poppies had sleep in their veins and hellebore death, and yarrow could close over wounds. All these things had to be worked and learned through errors and trials, burnt fingers and fetid clouds that sent me running outside to cough in the garden. At least, I thought, in those early days, once I cast a spell, I would not have to learn it again. But even that was not true. However often I had used a herb before, each cutting had its own character. One rose would give up its secrets if it were ground, another must be pressed, a third steeped. Each spell was a mountain to be climbed anew. All I could carry with me from the last time was the knowledge that it could be done. I pressed on. If my childhood had given me anything, it was endurance. Little by little, I began to listen better, to the sap moving in the plants, to the blood in my veins. I learned to understand my own intention to prune and to add, to feel where the power gathered and speak the right words to draw it to its height. That was the moment I lived for, when it all came clear at last and the spell could sing with its pure note for me and me alone. I did not call dragons or summon serpents. My earliest charms were silly things, whatever came into my head. I started with an acorn, for I had some thought that if the object were green and growing, nourished by water, my naiad blood might give me some help. For days, months, I rubbed that acorn with oils and salves, speaking words over it to make it sprout. I tried to mimic the sounds I had heard Aietes make when he had healed my face. I tried curses and prayers, too. But through it all, the acorn kept its seed smugly within. I threw it out the window and got a new one, and crouched over that for another half an age. I tried the spell when I was angry, when I was calm, when I was happy, when I was half-distracted. One day I told myself that I would rather have no powers than try that spell again. What did I want with an oak seedling anyway? The island was full of them. What I really wanted was a wild strawberry to slip sweetly down my irritable throat, and so I told that brown hull. It changed so fast my thumb sank into its soft red body. I stared, and then I whooped with triumph, startling the birds outside from their trees. I brought a withered flower back to life. I banished flies from my house. I made the cherries blossom out of season and turned the fire vivid green. If Aietes had been there, he would have choked on his beard to see such kitchen tricks. Yet because I knew nothing, nothing was beneath me. My powers lapped upon themselves like waves. I found I had a knack for illusion, summoning shadow crumbs for the mice to creep after, making pale minnows leap from the waves beneath a cormorant's beak. I thought larger, a ferret to frighten off the moles, an owl to keep away the rabbits. I learned that the best time to harvest was beneath the moon, when dew and darkness concentrated sap. I learned what grew well in a garden and what must be left to its place in the woods. I caught snakes and learned how to milk their teeth. I could coax a drop of venom from the tail of a wasp. I healed a dying tree. I killed a poisonous vine with a touch. But Aietes had been right. My greatest gift was transformation, and that was always where my thoughts returned. I stood before a rose and it became an iris. A draft poured onto the roots of an ash tree changed it into a holm oak. I turned all my firewood to cedar so that its scent would fill my halls each night. I caught a bee and made it into a toad, and a scorpion into a mouse. There I discovered at last the limits of my power. However potent the mixture, however well woven the spell, the toad kept trying to fly, and the mouse to sting. Transformation touched only bodies, not minds. I thought of Scylla then. Did her nymph self live still inside that six-headed monster? Or did plants grown from the blood of gods make the change a true one? I did not know. Into the air, I said, wherever you are, I hope you are finding your satisfaction. Which, of course, now I know she was. It was one day during that time that I found myself among the thickest brakes of the forest. I loved to walk the island, from its lowest shores to its highest haunts,
seeking out the hidden mosses and ferns and vines, collecting their leaves for my charms. It was late afternoon, and my basket overflowed. I stepped around a bush, and the boar was there. I had known for some time that there were wild pigs on the island. I'd heard them squealing and crashing in the brush, and often I would find some rhododendron trampled or a stand of saplings rooted up. This was the first one I had seen. He was huge, even bigger than I had imagined a boar could be. His spine rose steep and black as the ridges of Mount Kynthos, and his shoulders were slashed with the thunderbolt scars of his fights. Only the bravest heroes face such creatures. And then they are armed with spears and dogs, archers and assistants, and usually half a dozen warriors besides. I had only my digging knife and my basket and not a single spell draught to hand. He stamped, and the white foam dripped from his mouth. He lowered his tusks and ground his jaws. His pig eyes said, "I can break 100 youths and send their bodies back to wailing mothers. I will tear your entrails and eat them for my lunch." I fixed my gaze on his. "Try," I said. For a long moment, he stared at me. Then he turned and twitched off through the brush. I tell you, for all my spells, that was the first time I truly felt myself a witch. At my hearth that night, I thought of those prancing goddesses who carry birds on their shoulders, or have some fawn always nuzzling their hands, tripping delicately at their heels. I would put them to shame, I thought. I climbed to the highest peaks and found a lonely track. Here a flower crushed. Here the dirt turned a little and some bark clawed off. I brewed a potion with crocus and yellow jasmine, iris and cypress root dug at the moon's full height. I sprinkled it, singing, "I summon you." She came rippling through my door at the next dusk, her shoulder muscles hard as stones. She lay across my hearth and rasped my ankles with her tongue. During the day, she brought me rabbits and fish. At night, she licked honey from my fingers and slept upon my feet. Sometimes we would play, she stalking behind me, then leaping up to grapple me by the neck. I smelled the hot musk of her breath, felt the weight of her forepaws pressing on my shoulders. "Look," I said, showing her the knife I had carried with me from my father's halls, the one stamped with a lion's face. "What fool made this? They have never seen your like." She cracked her great brown mouth in a yawn. There was a bronze mirror in my bedroom, tall as the ceiling. When I passed it, I scarcely knew myself. My gaze seemed brighter, my face sharper, and there behind me paced my wild lion familiar. I could imagine what my cousins would say if they saw me, my feet dirty from working in the garden, my skirts knotted up around my knees, singing at the height of my frail voice. I wished that they would come. I wanted to see those goggle eyes of theirs as I walked among the dens of wolves, swam in the sea where the sharks fed. I could change a fish to a bird. I could wrestle with my lion, then lie across her belly, my hair loose around me. I wanted to hear them squeal and gasp, breath struck. "Oh, she looked at me. Now I will be a frog." Had I truly feared such creatures? Had I really spent 10,000 years ducking like a mouse? I understood now Aeti's boldness, how he had stood before our father like a towering peak. When I did my magics, I felt that same span and heft. I tracked my father's burning chariot across the sky. "Well, what do you have to say to me? You threw me to the crows, but it turns out I prefer them to you." No answer came. And none from my Aunt Moon either. Those cowards. My skin was glowing. My teeth set. My lioness lashed her tail. "Does no one have the courage? Will no one dare to face me?" So you see, in my way, I was eager for what came. Chapter 8. It was sunset. My father's face already dipped beneath the trees. I was working in my garden, staking the leggy vines, planting rosemary and aconite. I was singing, too, some aimless air. The lion lay in the grass, her mouth bloodied from the woodgrass she had flushed. "I admit," the voice said, "I am surprised to see you so plain after such boasting. a flower garden and braids. You might be any country girl.
The young man was leaning against my house, watching me.
His hair was loose and tousled, his face bright as a jewel. Though there was no light to catch them, his golden sandals gleamed.
I knew who he was, of course I knew.
The power shone from his face, unmistakable, keen as an unsheathed blade. An Olympian, the son of Zeus and his chosen messenger, that laughing gadfly of the gods, Hermes.
I felt myself tremble, but I would not let him see it. Great gods smell fear like sharks smell blood, and they will devour you for it just the same.
I stood. What did you expect?
Oh, you know, a slim wand twirled idly in his fingers. Something more lurid, dragonish, a troop of dancing sphinxes, blood dripping from the sky.
I was used to my thick-shouldered uncles with their white beards, not such perfect, careless beauty. When sculptors shape their stone, they shape it after him.
Is that what they say of me? Of course. Zeus is sure you're brewing poisons against us all, you and your brother both. You know how he frets.
He smiled, easy, conspiratorial, as if the anger of Zeus were only a light jest.
So you come as Zeus's spy, then?
I prefer the word envoy. But no, in this matter, my father can do his own work. I'm here because my brother is angry with me.
Your brother? I said.
Yes, he said. I think you've heard of him.
From his cloak, he drew a lyre, inlaid with gold and ivory, glowing like the dawn.
I'm afraid I've stolen this, he said, and I need a place to shelter till the storm passes. I was hoping you might take pity upon me. Somehow, I don't think he'll look here.
The hairs stood on the back of my neck. All who were wise feared the god Apollo's wrath, silent as sunlight, deadly as plague. I had the impulse to look over my shoulder to make sure he was not striding across the sky already, his gilded arrow pointed at my heart. But there was something in me that was sick of fear and awe, of gazing at the heavens and wondering what someone would allow me.
Come in, I said, and led him through my door.
I had grown up hearing the stories of Hermes's daring. How as an infant he had risen from his cradle and made off with Apollo's cattle. How he had slain the monstrous guardian Argos after coaxing each of his thousand eyes to sleep. How he could pry secrets out of a stone and charm even rival gods to do his will. It was all of it true. He could draw you in as if he were winding up a thread. He could spin you out upon a conceit until you were choking with laughter. I had scarcely known true intelligence. I had spoken to Prometheus for only a moment. And in all the rest of Oceanus's halls, most of what passed as cleverness was only archness and spite. Hermes's mind was a thousand times sharper and more swift. It shone like light upon the waves, dazzling to blindness. That night he entertained me with tale after tale of the great gods and their foolishness. Lecherous Zeus turning into a bull to lure a pretty maiden. Ares, god of war, bested by two giants who kept him crammed in a jar for a year. Hephaestus laying a trap for his wife, Aphrodite, hoisting her in a golden net, still naked with her lover Ares, for all the gods to see. On and on he went, through the absurd vices, drunken brawls and petty slapping squabbles, all told in that same slippery, grinning voice. I felt myself flushed and dizzied, as if I had taken my own draughts.
Will you not be punished for coming here and breaking my exile?
He smiled. Father knows I do what I like. And anyway, I break nothing. It is only you who are confined. The rest of the world may come and go as we please.
I was surprised. But I thought, is it not the greater punishment to force me to be alone?
That depends on who visits you, doesn't it? But exile is exile. Zeus wanted you contained, and so you are. He didn't really think about it further.
How do you know all this?
I was there. Watching Zeus and Helios negotiate is always good entertainment. Like two volcanoes trying to decide if they should blow.
He had fought in the Great War, I remembered. He had seen the sky burn and slain a giant whose head brushed the clouds. For all his lightness, I found I could imagine it.
Tell me, I said, can you play that instrument? Or only steal it?
He touched his fingers to the strings. The notes leapt out into the air, bright and silver sweet. He gathered them into a melody as effortlessly as if he were a god of music himself, so that the whole room seemed to live inside the sound. He looked up, the fire caught in his face. "Do you sing?" That was another thing about him. He made you want to spill your secrets. "Only for myself," I said. "My voice is not pleasing to others. I am told it sounds like a gull crying."
"Is that what they said? You are no gull. You sound like a mortal."
The confusion must have been plain on my face, for he laughed.
"Most gods have voices of thunder and rocks. We must speak soft to human ears, or they are broken to pieces. To us, mortals sound faint and thin."
I remembered how gentle Glaucus's words had sounded when he had first spoken to me. I had taken it for a sign.
"It is not common," he said, "but sometimes lesser nymphs are born with human voices.
Such a one are you."
Why did no one tell me? And how could it be? There is no mortal in me. I am Titan only.
He shrugged.
"Who can ever explain how divine bloodlines work? As for why no one said, I suspect they didn't know. I spend more time with mortals than most gods and have grown accustomed to their sounds. To me it is only another flavor, like season in food. But if you are ever among men, you'll notice it.
They won't fear you, as they fear the rest of us."
In a minute he had unraveled one of the great mysteries of my life. I raised my fingers to my throat as if I could touch the strangeness that lay there, a god with a mortal's voice. It was a shock, and yet there was a part of me that felt something almost like recognition.
"Play," I said. I began to sing, and the lyre followed my voice effortlessly, its timbre rising to sweeten my every phrase. When I finished, the flames were down to their coals and the moon veiled. Its eyes shone like dark gems held to light. They were black, one of the marks of deep-running power from the line of the oldest gods. For the first time, it struck me how strange it was that we divide Titans from Olympians, when of course Zeus was born from Titan parents, and Hermes' own grandfather was the Titan Atlas. The same blood runs in all our veins.
"Do you know the name of this island?" I said.
"I would be a poor god of travelers if I did not know all the places in the world."
"And will you tell me?"
"It is called Aiaia," he said.
"Aiaia," I tasted the sounds. They were soft, folding quietly as wings in the darkened air.
"You know it," he said. He was watching me closely.
"Of course. It is the place where my father threw his strength to Zeus and proved his loyalty. In the sky above this place, he vanished a Titan giant, drenching the land with blood."
"It is quite a coincidence," he said, "that your father would send you to this island among all the others."
I could feel his power reaching for my secrets. In the old days, I would have rushed forth with a brimming cup of answers to give him all he wanted, but I was not the same as I had been. I owed him nothing. He would have of me only what I wanted to give.
I rose and stood before him. I could feel my own eyes, yellow as river stones.
"Tell me," I said, "how do you know that your father is not right about my poisons? How do you know I will not drug you where you sit?"
"I do not."
"Yet you would dare to stay?"
"I dare anything," he said.
"And that is how we came to be lovers."
Hermes returned often in the years that followed, winging through the dusk. He brought delicacies of the gods, wine stolen from Zeus's own stores, the sweetest honey of Mount Hybla, where the bees drink only thyme and linden blossoms. Our conversations were pleasures and our couplings were the same.
"Will you bear my child?" he asked me.
I laughed at him. "No, never and never." He was not hurt. He liked such sharpness, for there was nothing in him that had any blood you might spill. He asked only for curiosity's sake, because it was his nature to seek out answers, to press others for their weaknesses. He wanted to see how moonish I was over him. But all the sop in me was gone. I did not lie dreaming of him during the days. I did not speak his name into my pillow. He was no husband, scarcely even a friend. He was a poisoned snake, and I was another, and on such terms we pleased ourselves.
He gave me the news that I had missed. In his travels, he passed over every quarter of the world, picking up gossip as hens gather mud. He knew whose feasts Glaucus drank at. He knew how high the milk spurted in Colchis's fountains. He told me that Aetes was well, arrayed in a cloak of dyed leopard skin. He had taken a mortal to wife, and had a babe in swaddling, and another in the belly. Pasiphae still ruled Crete with her potions, and had in the meantime whelped a ship's crew for her husband. Half a dozen, heirs and daughters both. Perses kept to the east, raising the dead with pails of cream and blood. My mother had gotten over her tears and added Mother of Witches to her titles, swanning with it among my aunts. We laughed over all of it, and when he left, I knew he told stories of me in turn. My dirt-black fingernails, my musky lion, the pigs that had begun coming to my door, truffling for slops and a scratch on the back, and, of course, how I had thrown myself upon him as a blushing virgin. Well, I had not blushed, but all the rest was true enough. I questioned him further, where Aiaia was and how far it was from Egypt and Ethiopia and every other interesting place. I asked how my father's mood waxed, and what the names of my nieces and nephews were, and what empires flourished new in the world. He answered everything. But when I asked him how far to those flowers I had given Glaucus and Scylla, he laughed at me. Do you think I will sharpen the lioness's claws for her? I made my voice as careless as I could. And what of that old titan Prometheus on his rock? How fares he? How do you think? He loses a liver a day. Still, I have never understood why helping mortals made Zeus so angry. Tell me, he said, who gives better offerings, a miserable man or a happy one? A happy one, of course. Wrong, he said. A happy man is too occupied with his life. He thinks he is beholden to no one. But make him shiver, kill his wife, cripple his child, then you will hear from him. He will starve his family for a month to buy you a pure white yearling calf. If he can afford it, he will buy you 100. But surely, I said, you have to reward him eventually, otherwise he will stop offering. Oh, you would be surprised how long he will go on. But yes, in the end, it's best to give him something. Then he will be happy again, and you can start over. So this is how Olympians spend their days, thinking of ways to make men miserable. There's no cause for righteousness, he said. Your father is better at it than anyone. He would raise a whole village if he thought it would get him one more cow. How many times had I gloated inwardly over my father's heaping altars? I lifted my cup and drank so he would not see the flush on my cheeks. I suppose you might go and visit Prometheus, I said. You and your wings. Bring him something for comfort. And why should I do that? For novelty's sake, of course. The first good deed in your dissolute life. Aren't you curious what it would feel like? He laughed, but I did not press him further. He was still, always, an Olympian. Still Zeus's son. I was allowed license because it amused him, but I never knew when that amusement might end. You can teach a viper to eat from your hands, but you cannot take away how much it likes to bite. Spring passed into summer. One night, when Hermes and I were lingering over our wine, I finally asked him about Scylla herself. Ah, his eyes lit. I wondered when we would come to her. What would you know? Is she unhappy? But he would have laughed at such a mewling question, and he would have been right too. My witchcraft, the island, my lion, all of them sprang from her transformation. There was no honesty in regretting what had given me my life. I never heard what happened to her after she dived into the sea. Do you know where she is? Not far from here. Less than a day's journey by mortal ship. She has found a strait she likes. On one side is a whirlpool that sucks down ships and fish and whatever else passes. On the other, a cliff face with a cave for her to hide her head. Any ship which would avoid the whirlpool is driven right into her jaws, and so she feeds. Feeds? I said. Yes, she eats sailors. 6 at a time, 1 for each mouth. And if the oars are too slow, she takes 12. A few of them try to fight her, but you can imagine how that works out. You can hear them screaming for quite a ways.
I was frozen to my chair. I had always imagined her swimming in the deeps, sucking cold flesh from squids. But no.
Scylla had always wanted the light of day. She had always wanted to make others weep. And now she was a ravening monster filled with teeth.